This is the Division 2, Division 3 podcast.
Welcome back to the Inside the Cross Division 2, Division 3 podcast. I'm your co-host, Kyle Devitt, and I am joined, as always now, I think we're cemented as a duo, Josh Davey. Josh, what's going on, man?
Not much, dude. Fired up to be here. As Danny DeVito on Always Sunny would say, we are the we are the gruesome twosome now. So Matt Kinnear has handled a lot of the interview stuff, and Kyle and I are going to dive into a little bit of the dirtier info, and excited to just keep this thing moving, man. April 1st, finally April.
Yeah, I can't believe it, especially when Monday was such an awful day for everyone, and mostly just people that like to look at memes or jokes. I was not here for it, man. As someone that tries to work in like a new space, April Fool's Day is a literal nightmare.
Well, there was certainly some inherently controversial news, and it's just the worst day to break news. I don't understand how people can't figure that out.
Yeah, well, mistakes happen, but we're going to start out by going through a scoreboard recap. We're going to roll through D2, two big games to talk about from the last week. The first one is the one we kind of told you guys to watch, and that is Adelphi 13 Pace 9. That happened last Wednesday, so sorry we're getting back in the Wayback Machine. It's a full week ago. I actually watched this whole contest. Pace came back in the game late, but Adelphi really cruised and just beat the Retrievers up in transition. Adelphi has a ton of really skilled midfielders, and they're big and athletic and strong, and I think I was really surprised by that, because I think Adelphi isn't necessarily in that in the NE10, at least, known as a team that is super, super athletic. They're very, you know, not formulaic either. They're just kind of reactionary as a team. I think that, you know, if you're thinking about teams that are super athletic, they're thinking about the Lemoynes and, you know, the Merrimacks of that conference. But I think Adelphi is now definitely, I mean, they're undefeated and they've performed well against every other team that they've played. I think they're in that conversation with those top three players, and we got to give them a little more respect, a little more burn down the road.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think Anish and those guys over the weekend covering some of the games on ESPNU, I think one of the top five plays was it from this game? I know it was an Adelphi play.
I don't believe it was this game, although it could have been the full field defensive run goal.
It was an Adelphi player, I believe, just shooting it right over his right over his head going in.
Oh, yeah. I don't think that was this game, but it was, they have playmakers. They've got skill. They're fun to watch. If you get a chance to watch them, their streams are also pretty decent. A lot of the D2 teams have great streams. But yeah, definitely a team to watch going forward. The other result from this past weekend, another game we kind of told you guys to check out, is Belmont Abbey 13, Mount Olive 8. I think that, you know, I love Belmont Abbey. It was a toss-up we're putting out the magazine this week to the printer, and it was a toss-up between doing an article on Belmont Abbey or U-Indy. And unfortunately, the tiebreaker was that U-Indy beat Belmont Abbey and handed them their only loss. So we went with U-Indy, but Belmont Abbey is a team I like to watch. Noah Haas, Liam Osborne combined for 8 goals here. Matt Olive's still a very good team. I think they just were a little overwhelmed because Belmont Abbey attacks you from the alleys and just gets the ball past you no matter who you are. And they also have a great goaltender in Bryce Gifford, who had 17 saves in the win for them here. They're 10-1. They're looking pretty sharp and looking like a team we need to stay with as the season keeps advancing. And it's funny because we're going to talk about this a little later. It started last week. There's a lot of conference games coming up, and some of those games aren't as exciting, and that's an across the board D2 D3 thing, because, you know, if you're in a conference, everyone has to play you, so you're going to play teams that are kind of at the bottom of the conference. If you're at the top, that'll lead to some lopsided results. I think we're kind of past the big upset stage for D2 and D3. I think the thing now is to watch the conference matchups and see who can kind of better themselves in those top three positions in each conference and maybe pull an upset there. But I don't think we're going to see, you know, a team that's ninth in a conference and winless beat a team that's second anywhere.
I agree. I think at this point, teams sort of are really in stride. They know who they are, what their identity is, and it certainly can happen. You know, in a couple of these games whether there's a rivalry that has been built in the past, you know, some of those games are probably a little closer than they should be. But I agree, you're not going to see the team who, you know, hasn't won a conference game at the end of April beating a team that's a top 20, most likely, in D2 or D3. I do agree with you. But doesn't mean it can't, you know, they can't muck it up and make it really close and you know, make them sweat a little bit going into it. You can't overlook anyone in 2019.
That's for sure. Another thing we're going to do is we're going to cover the scoreboard recap for D3. Josh, I think you've got a barn burner here. This actually caught the attention of publisher Terry Foy, who asked me if this upset was as big as he thought it was. Josh, what do you think?
The answer to that question is no. Illinois Wesleyan is legit. They are 8-1. So they were playing Ohio Wesleyan, who has been a perennial power along with Denison, basically in the Midwest. When you think of D3 lacrosse in Ohio, those are the first two teams that come to mind. Ohio Wesleyan under Coach Mike Plantholt and Denison under Coach Caravana. So Ohio Wesleyan's had a really strange year. They're 4-6 right now. They got beat by some teams that are, you know, not your, you know, powerhouse teams. They lost to Salisbury really bad. They lost to a couple of teams bad. Whereas Illinois Wesleyan's one of those teams that just they put up so many points. So they had 17 points. But this game was, it was a final score was 17-15. So a great game for fans in attendance. But the coolest part about this game is Ohio Wesleyan, who lost this game by two, was up 14-7 with 7 minutes left in the third quarter. They doubled them up 14-7, and Illinois Wesleyan came fighting back. So Illinois Wesleyan goes on a basically 10-1 run over the, you know, last 5 minutes of the third quarter, and didn't let Ohio Wesleyan score a goal. Oh, they gave up one goal in the fourth quarter to come back and win this thing. You know, they had, I think, like 23 points total. Rick Smith had four goals. Will Rossi had three goals. Ty Collins with two. Bailey Marth with two. A lot of guys with some assists. The goalie played great in Cage. This is a team that, you know, their only losses to Salisbury, and they got kind of shellacked. I think it was like a 22-6 score or something. But they're legit. Like, they're a team that, you know, could get a pool B or C bid, depending on, you know, how they finish in their conference, and go into the NCAA tournament and win a game, like an unexpected. They could beat a team that, you know, maybe our listeners are more familiar with because they've talked about, right? They could go in and probably contend with a landmark team or a team from a conference that isn't necessarily putting someone in the Final Four of Division III every year. So it's cool to show a school like this some love. I don't know if it's like a massive upset. I think to the fan who's not paying as much attention, they're like, oh my God, Wesleyan's 4-6. They lost to this team, Illinois Wesleyan, Battle of the Wesleyans. They're legit though, and they're continuing to get better. And people are going to want to play for a school where you're averaging 20 goals a game. Like, who wouldn't want to be a part of that offense? So, shout out to them. It's a great win for them. Continue, you know, puts them on a map. The fact that we're talking about them alone, you know, on this podcast for as long as I've been ranting about them right now is, pretty cool in itself. So, a big win for them. Ohio Wesleyan reeling a little bit. They're going to have to win their AQ, which means they're going to have to go through Denison to try to make the NCAA tournament at this point.
Yeah, I think you mentioned people are excited about Illinois Wesleyan this year. People were excited last year when they were putting up similar stats without the shot clock. So this is a team that plays at this pace on purpose, straight up D3 fun and gun, which I don't think we see a lot of, to be honest with you. I don't think that's something that we're seeing from top teams. But I think, you know, if they catch someone on the right day, that we're talking about not a lot of upsets left. The upsets come in the tournament, and if you're looking for a sleeper, Illinois Wesleyan might be that sleeper. Josh, another result that I think you want to speak about: Washington and Lee 13, Roanoke 8.
Yeah, you know, as we get into some of the ODAC play here, you know, these are meaningful games based on two teams that have played really strong out of conference schedules. It was a close game into the first half. It was 6-5 at halftime, and then WNL went on a 4-0 run in the third quarter. They really dominated the faceoff X. So I think it's a game of note to talk about, just because, you know, when you're trying to gauge a team like WNL and whether they're NCAA tournament bound, if they don't win the AQ, they don't win the ODAC championship, I think these are games that are meaningful. You know, Roanoke is 7-4. They haven't really had a lot of great wins. I think their biggest win thus far is probably Stevens Tech, which is a good win. They're top, you know, I think they're like 12 or 13 in the poll this week. So, you know, it's a game of note. A.J. Witherell continues to be just a monster. Still in the running for Player of the Year, I think, with between him and Nally up at RIT, Sean Nally. Those are probably the two of the front runners at this point. So, yeah, 13-8. WNL kind of sets himself up where now, based on how Lynchburg plays against Roanoke this weekend, you know, you're looking at a WNL-Lynchburg matchup in a few weeks that's really, really enticing and could set them some things and ruffle some feathers, so to speak, in the South when it comes Selection Sunday.
Once again, impressed with your ability to work Lynchburg in to every conversation that
I'm
we have
pro.
On the podcast.
Listen, we're talking ODAC. It's natural. I was talking about this with a parent of a Lynchburg team the other day. I was like, I don't know if I have a reason to mention Lynchburg in this podcast, but I will later in this podcast. In a, you know, it'll be, it's worth it, and it makes sense later. So we can scrub this from right now, but we can move on. But yeah, relevant, man. Every time I got a chance to, I'm gonna do it.
All right. Well, since you indulged, I will also indulge. It's not great news for my Clark Cougars as they lost to Coast Guard 14-13 in the fourth annual Rennie Classic hosted at Clark. When I did the piece this fall for the Coast Guard guys, I told them that I would root for them against every team they play except Clark. And lo and behold, as soon as the score was final, got some tweets, man. Got some tweets. Hey, what do you think about this? My answer to those tweets is, I'm kind of bummed out. I wanted my school to win. It's not a choice. You know what I mean? Like, it's not a choice. They lost in heartbreaking fashion, like 8 seconds left on the clock. Coast Guard's at 7-2. They're, you know, 1-0 in the new MAC. Clark is, you know, in the Ohio Wesleyan territory of 4-6 and winless in the new MAC so far. So I'm a little bummed, but as long as we beat Babson, Wheaton, and MIT, I'm a happy Clark U alum. I don't know if all those things are going to happen, but hopefully they do, because those are the rival schools. Let's move on to games to watch this week. So this podcast is going to come out on a Wednesday. We're going to just give you guys some games to maybe check out after you listen to this, or, you know, maybe they're going on right now and you can kind of simultaneously listen, which would be an excellent feat of technology. The first game we're going to talk about is a pivotal D2 matchup, and it's Lake Erie versus Indy. This is a big matchup because UIndy only has, you know, one loss. Lake Erie is at a point in their season where they need a win. Indianapolis is one of the sleeper teams that we are not talking about, which is why, again, I wrote an entire article about them. Coach Greg Stocks, you know, actually is known for building the Lake Erie program before he went to Indianapolis. The most interesting thing about this UIndy team is it's only been around. This is their fourth year. They have 12 seniors that have been there since they were freshmen in the first class that are playing right now that are seniors.
That's so
incredible
cool.
Retention.
That is so
first
cool.
First of all, yeah. It's awesome. Like, all those kids, and a lot of them are starters. You know, they're all leaders. You know, Parker Kump is the guy that probably everyone's talking about. He got drafted by the Coquitlam Adnacks. I think I said that right, with the right Canadian accent.
Sounded good. Sounded good.
Yeah, sounded good. Yeah. And in the WLA, he's an amazing scorer. He's one of the, you know, a Canadian finisher, yes, but the thing that he's demonstrated this past, you know, in his senior year is his ability to pass. He actually broke the UIndy record for assists in a game a couple weeks ago with 5. So, you know, it's a young team, and I think people aren't talking about them a lot. It's pretty exciting. They play a really high octane brand of lacrosse. And I, you know, in their first year, they actually upset Lake Erie, and that was kind of something that Coach Stocks and I talked about, you know, going from the school to a new school with a whole bunch of new kids and then beating your old team is actually like kind of an emotional experience. I've done that. It's a weird feeling. I did it when I was an assistant at Franklin Pierce. I went to St. A's the next year and we played them, and you know, the Franklin Pierce kids are like hugging me in the line, and I'm like, is this okay? Like, it's a weird feeling. You're beating someone you actually like kind of built. But for them, I think this game still has a little, you know, resonance for the coach a little bit. It's you know, it's 3-4 years removed. But I think it's definitely something you want to keep an eye out for a midweek game.
That dynamic is really interesting. The young coach who goes from their alma mater to another school that they play often. I have so many buddies who coach at Franklin and Marshall or Hampton Sydney or other just Division III schools who end up playing Lynchburg. And I always wonder what that's like. You know, it's kind of weird. Like, if you win, you're pumped. But at the same time, you're also like bummed that Lynchburg lost. And if you lose, is there something to be said like, oh, you lost, but you know what, my boy. I don't know. I mean, you're obviously all in for the school that is paying you to be there and the one that you're right. investing your time and effort and sweat equity into. But it is an interesting dynamic, one that I thought's been, you know, hasn't been talked about a lot. I think the other one that's sort of like that is, you know, my senior year, we had three assistant coaches who had all played, who were, when I was a junior, they were all seniors and they all became GAs and all played. So that dynamic of like, I was just living with this guy and now he's coaching me. So like, you know, you really have to, you know, not think about all the stuff you did socially with them and start thinking about, all right, I need to look at this person in a different light, but it's weird. So, you know, those dynamics alone of like these, it's what's cool about Division II and Division III lacrosse is so many people get so passionate about their alma mater as they want to stay and be a GA and be a part of it. And then they continue to move on and expand. But, you know, that dynamic is really interesting. I'm glad you kind of hit on that.
Yeah. Let's just say that, when I became a head coach, I never scheduled Clark because it would have been too much.
Yeah, it's weird.
You know what I mean? It's too much. It's like, if you, especially if you, I mean, I feel like one of the things that separates D2 and D3 a lot from D1 is, and this isn't 100% true at all, I'm just saying, I think in my experience with people from D2 and D3 schools versus D1 schools that played at that school, the attachment you have for your school is, I think, more palpable. And like you, I feel like you, not that you get more out of D2 or D3 compared to D1. That's not what I'm saying. I feel like the emotional connection that you have to your school and your kind of loyalty is so palpable. Like, you feel it all the time. Like, if someone talks about your school, you're like super excited to talk about them.
Totally.
You know what I mean?
Doesn't necessarily come in everyday conversation. Like, we're talking about, you know, Michigan State right now. It's like, oh, they're in the Final Four. You know, they're in the news somewhat regularly, right? These big schools. So when someone has opportunity to talk some little school from New Hampshire or some small school in Southern Virginia, like, you get really fired up about that.
Yeah. It's one of the best conversations you can kind of get trapped in lacrosse, the lacrosse trap of like, hey, where'd you play? Is it, you should never ask people that.
Well, it's your
because
point
then
about
you're there for 15 minutes.
Totally. I mean, that's like, especially when you live in Baltimore down here, it's like every other bro walking down Light Street has their, you know, McDaniel lacrosse sweatshirt on or whatever. But anyway, like, think about Coach Tierney, you know, like this past week at Denver and Princeton, how emotional he was. Now, I'm not even going to come close to talking about how, like, your and I's experiences or anything like what he's gone through. But,
right.
You know, look, think about how emotional a guy who's this, you know, stoic figure and he's tough and he's been through it all and he's the legendary Coach Tierney, and he's shedding tears before that game because it's, you know, you invest a lot of time and, like I said, sweat equity, and you build a relationship with these places. And, you know, when you, it brings back a lot of memories, and the last thing you want to see is that team lose. You know, if Denver is going to lose, the team I'm sure he wants to win is Princeton, you know, and every Saturday, Wednesday, whenever they're playing. So we got a little sidetracked here, but I feel like it was a good little D3 life sort of sidebar.
No, it's great. And I just want to reiterate this because people take words and twist them. I'm not saying that D2 and D3 is like better or gives you a, that's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying it's rarer, I think, when, because there's less people that went to your school. So when you finally have that, when you connect with that and you connect with someone else that kind of went through that or is going through that emotional kind of connection point, that's so visceral and so felt by people that have shared that experience. And I think people that are D2 and D3 fans that are listening to this are you know, get it. They agree.
You don't really get it unless you're a part of it, right?
Yeah, and that's, yes, it's exclusionary, but I don't want to exclude people. We're about bringing people in, and to do that, again, we're going to talk about a monster midweek game in D3, a NESCAC throwdown, Amherst versus Wesleyan.
Kyle, real quick, before you jump into this, is this the most important game of Division 3 lacrosse this year. I would argue there's one other game that might be more important that has already taken place, but I think this could be the most, the biggest game in terms of how it affects the rest of the North come NCAA time. That's not a conference or NCAA tournament game.
I think it's the most informational game that we're going to see.
It's a good way to describe it.
Before the playoffs. Do you know what I mean? I feel like
totally.
This is where we figure out which of these teams is an actual title contender. And the loser doesn't necessarily become fodder, right? They're not just thrown away. Unless the worst case scenario for both of these teams is a blowout. I don't see it happening. I don't think it can happen. I think the one thing that you're going to see here is a push and pull of the tempo of this contest, because both of these teams are bullies in the best way possible. They want the ball. They don't want you to have the ball. But if you do have it, the first thing they want to do is take it away from you or force you to take an absolutely atrocious shot. And they're also both very good at doing that. They have mean, skilled defenders. Wesleyan uses the zone. Amherst uses pressure D. They both can run. I think Amherst is a little more comfortable running with the ball. But yeah, the clash of – it's a clash of titans, really, and it's not just because it's NESCAC. These teams could play anywhere, and if these two teams are going to meet, like, that's a game that I want to watch. It's totally a game I absolutely want to watch.
I think the X factor in this game, and it's not really an X factor when you're talking about a team's best player, but, you know, Evan Wolf's ability to – you know, my high school team, we play a zone, and the biggest thing we struggle with is, like, you know, when someone does dodge, because you're not necessarily told to dodge against the zone, right? Like, when you're playing against the zone, people are like, oh, let's run our man up play, or let's, you know, right, step into seams and try to move the ball. And but, like, the ability for Evan Wolf to be able to create and dodge a shorty, right? If I'm Coach Thompson, I'm putting Evan Wolf on sort of like the top wing, righty wing. I'm going to hitch down to the, you know, backside, try to get to the middle, draw one, and then get the ball to my stick real quick. His ability and you know, to change direction and, you know, draw slides, I think is going to be the biggest part of it. And again, we're talking about one of the best zones in college across. So these guys have seen it all. So I think his ability to create for others, right? Not necessarily make the hero play, but get the hockey assist or two passes away from a goal. I wouldn't be surprised if he doesn't have as heroic of an effort on the stat sheet, but has 4, 5, 6 hockey assists in this game, having a lot of things create coming out of his stick.
Yeah, I think one of his best attributes too, just like, you know, his brother Jordan, is attacking from X. And Wesleyan's actually – zones are also if you mentioned how you would attack a zone, the first thing I would do to attack a zone is try to see how far I could get past GLE from X, right? That's one of the things that you test where the slide's coming from. You adjust. You move some picks in. You move the ball around, and you try to create an opportunity for that guy to drive and dunk. And by the way, no better player to give an opportunity to drive and dunk than Evan Wolf. So I'm with you there. On the other side of the ball, it's really interesting because, you know, Carter Hawthorne's a different kind of player. He's more like, if you're going to compare his styles, he's more like Minikis on Amherst than he is like Wolf. He's a surveyor. He's a playmaker. He's a guy that, again, also likes to operate at X, but he's a facilitator with his passing, not so much as dodging, but he can dodge and get big goals if he needs to. So I think it's going to be interesting to see who Amherst puts on him, how quick they slide to him. They got to watch out for a cross-field feed to Ronan Jacoby, who is just a monster bomber. He's been a little off lately, but I think, you know, if he comes good here, he can get 3, 4, 5 goals. And then, you know, if we get into a tempo like we saw Amherst get into with RIT and like we saw Wesleyan get into with RIT last year in the NCAA playoffs, we could have a game of the year candidate right here. And then I won't have to drive to Wesleyan to go see them play Tufts.
There you go. I think outside of, you know, this game, the Amherst RIT game probably had the most implications in terms of North seeding, right? Because they're not, RIT's not the NESCAC. So their ability to, you know, presumably win their conference and have these out of conference wins against an Amherst sort of line, you know, kind of forces them to be the number one team in the North, assuming they don't, you know, fall somewhere in the next few weeks. But yeah, I mean, let's jump a little bit to Friday, Saturday, Sunday. because there are some, you know, as the NESCAC continues to just roll on. I mean, every 3 days there's just an insane matchup. Let's go D2 first, though. I know you have on our sort of a weekend preview, Seton Hill versus Mercyhurst. What are you seeing there?
Yeah, I think Seton Hill, you know, and Seton Hill was really the darlings of last year. But this year they've, you know, they've lost to UIndy, they lost to Lemoyne, and they lost to Limestone. They're still, you know, sporting a decent record, 6-3. Mercyhurst at home, they've been on the road a little bit too. Their last, you know, five games, or out of their last six games, five of them have been on the road. So now they're getting home. They got another long road trip coming up. This is a huge game for Seton Hill to win. I think that I don't want to say they're not as good as last year. I'm sure they learned a lot of lessons, and I know they learned a lot of lessons in the Merrimack game in the playoffs. But I feel like this is a team, you know, Coach Navani has his guys ready. They play a very, like, controlled but, like, smart style of lacrosse. I wouldn't say that they slow the ball down, but they know when to push. They know when to pull back. They've got a lot of guys with double-digit, you know, assist totals. They have seven guys with double-digit scoring totals. So that tells you how balanced they are. And I think it's a huge game for them. Mercyhurst, on the other hand, kind of looking to, you know, Mercyhurst is a former power. There's a lot of, you know, pretty famous Mercyhurst people out there. You know, they're out in lacrosse. They're like the D2 version of, like, Springfield. You know, Teddy Jenner being the most obvious. Shout out to Teddy Jenner. One of my favorite people in lacrosse. But I think this is a big one for Seton Hill. And again, like we mentioned, there aren't a ton of wildly stellar games here because we are kind of getting the softer side of some conference matchups. But there is a couple conferences that it doesn't matter where you're playing and who you're playing in that conference. They're still important. Josh, why don't you talk about one of those in D3?
This is the matchup I circle every year, right? I have the Lynchburg schedule on my desk in my office, about 100 feet from here, and Lynchburg Roanoke on Friday night, 7 o'clock faceoff on Schellenberger Field. I mean, I get the chills talking about it. These are the games that it doesn't matter. You throw the records out the book, right? These are just two teams that really just do not like each other. You know, they're about an hour apart. Roanoke's going to come over to Lynchburg on a Friday night. On paper, Lynchburg has had a more successful season. Has Roanoke really hasn't gotten one of those big wins. The only one Lynchburg really has are Stevenson and F&M, and Stevenson kind of, you know, might not be as big as a win as we necessarily need it to be. F&M a big win, especially after they beat Gettysburg last week. But it doesn't really matter. Like, this game is going to be a battle. Every time we played these guys, you were like, oh, we were up 5 and then it disappears. Or we were down 3 and it disappeared. Each team's going to go on a run. I think a lot of it's going to come down to the faceoff X and ability to control the clock a little bit. I expect it to be a 13-10-ish game in favor of the Hornets. I think their offense is become so disciplined over the last 2 or 3 weeks. They had a couple of really easy games over the last two weeks in Randolph and Shenandoah, some of those lower conference teams that you were alluding to earlier, Kyle. So I think, you know, given the atmosphere and Lynchburg's in a similar situation at W&L where they need to win. They need it to be Lynchburg and W&L at the end, and one of those teams beat each other to sort of solidify their space in the South and, you know, be a legit contender. So I think Roanoke just has too many holes. They do have some players who are putting up some awesome points, but I think on the defensive side, they're just giving up too many goals. Jason Sorrow and Peter Lindley are two players to be aware of for Roanoke that could give Lynchburg some problems on the defensive end. But I think Lynchburg's in a stride right now. They got a couple of these games under their belt. Being at home, I think this one goes to them. But like I said, I wouldn't be surprised if it went the other way. These are games where nothing that has come prior to this matters. Nothing happens past years, anything like that. You're going to face it off and see what happens. So really looking forward to this one. This will definitely be one. I've given Joe Hutzler a shout out on this podcast before. Lynchburg's streaming is unbelievable with the different camera angles and really high level analysis as well. So hopefully it's a beautiful night down in the Hill City and we'll be able to watch a great one.
Yeah, the sounds like they're kind of each other's team's boogeyman.
Totally.
Yeah, that's the team you really don't like, but you kind of have to respect, but also, like, all you want to do is beat them. Yeah.
Yeah, I feel totally. You. No, I mean, it's like, you know, I think I beat them twice when I was in college. We lost to them more times than we won. We had a couple big wins, had a couple big losses, though, too. I mean, I remember a game specifically where we were up, like, 6 goals, and, you know, we were playing, and I was like, God, this is going to be a great night. It's Friday night. We were up by 6 in the fourth quarter, and we didn't win a faceoff the rest of the game, and they came back and won by 2, and that was the worst week of college across my entire life. Coach Kadelka, it was a long week, to say the least. So, and then we, you know, my senior year, we lost them during the regular season, and then we beat them in the NCAA tournament in, like, the third round. So there's no love lost between these two programs. Coach Pilot and Coach Kadelka are two of the most respected Division III coaches in all of lacrosse. So a lot at stake for both these programs as well, you know, specific to their 2019 seasons.
Yeah, you know, got to get on that grudge life train, guys. You know, it's part of the fun. It's part of the fun. The other two games that we're kind of alluding to here in D3 play, man, we have one amazing game midweek, Amherst-Wesleyan. We already talked about it. But we also have both of those teams in action against the other two breakout teams in the NESCAC this year. First up, we have Wesleyan versus Tufts. I have been tasked with going to this game. I will go to this game.
Don't dare him, folks. Don't dare him to go, because he will go.
It will take 3 hours to get there and 4 hours to get back in traffic, but I'll still go. I'll go for you guys, and also because Matt Kinnear already told me to. So I'm really looking forward to catching this in person. I've never seen a home game at Wesleyan. I don't think. I've been to several Tufts games because they're much closer. I actually used to live down the street from Tufts when I coached at Emerson in a different part of the city. Yeah, this is a big matchup, especially if Wesleyan drops one to Amherst. If Wesleyan wins against Amherst on Wednesday, this matchup becomes the new best game and informational game of the season.
Yeah, that's a good point.
It's a totally transactional move, dependent upon a result. I think that you could pick either one of these teams. I don't think that unless you have an allegiance to either one, you can say one team is definitively better than the other, especially in this instance. They both play, you know, fun styles of lacrosse to watch. I mean, people say zone's not fun. You should watch Wesleyan Zone. It's a lot of fun. Check it out. Forces really bad shots. If you like defense, watch some tape. I know if I'm bummed out, I'll just put on Wesleyan Zone right there. Check it out. I love backer zones, by the way. That's not. It's weird, but it's not as weird as it sounds. So I think that, you know, Wesleyan Tufts, and I believe Matt Kinnear has a interview with the Tufts head coach, Casey Anoffel, on this podcast.
He does.
So stay listening to that. Yeah, that's it's a titanic matchup. I can't even begin to kind of parse which part is the most important. I think the result here is the thing that really matters. You know, you will learn some things about these two teams, but when they play each other, they kind of go out of their minds and get out of their game plan, and it's very heated. You know, Tufts beat Wesleyan twice last year, and Wesleyan went on to win the national championship because Wesleyan beat them in the playoffs.
Yeah, that's a really good observation, and shows like this game matters for sure, but the only game that really will eventually matter is when the NESCAC tournament time comes around, right? I mean, we're going to learn a lot about Wesleyan quickly, but even if they lose and they go 0-2 over the next 4 days, there's no reason they can't win the NESCAC tournament and still go on to have, you know, a national championship season like they did last year.
Absolutely. Another NESCAC game we want to touch on. Again, it's Amherst versus Williams. Now you're probably saying, like, Williams, like, really? They're 6-1. They only lost to Wesleyan by 2 goals. And yes, that was the first game of the season. You can say whatever you want about it. It happened all the way back in early March. But I think what you need to focus on here when you're talking about Williams is a team that actually has it together and is very disciplined. I think the difference between this Williams team and the Williams team from last year is that the Williams team from last year had a lot of disruptive tendencies on offense where guys would just get frustrated and take bad shots. And I think that that's kind of been corrected. You know, we've seen, you know, they have a freshman in Jake Hayes, a kid from Wayland, Mass, who's got 20 points, and he's a midfielder. You know, they run their offense from different points. They are a tough team to play. I think beating Amherst is a tough ask. But I think this game is going to be close enough to really surprise people. And again, depending on the result earlier in the week between Amherst and Wesleyan, I think we might see maybe an angry Amherst here, which I'm all for teams that lose, get angry, and win totally. The next week. I love that. That's one of the best parts about sports is the emotional component. But I think that this is definitely one to keep an eye on. I think the marquee matchup is obviously Wesleyan Tufts, but this is a sneaky good game here in the NESCAC that can tell us a lot about both these teams.
Totally. What's cool, and you know, we can't forget that Williams lost to Wesleyan over, I mean, by the time this game is played, it'll be a month to the date, by 2 goals. So, you know, that's a really close game. And then they beat Bates, who ended up beating Wesleyan. And I hate playing that game, like this team beat this team, so they're better than this team.
Yeah.
But those are things to be aware of going in. The other thing that I really like about Williams is the geographic diversity of their roster. I know Williams is, you know, probably number one liberal arts school in the country, and an unbelievably desirable place to go to get an education. But when you think of like those NESCAC teams, like they're not a lot of Baltimore, Virginia, Delaware kids who end up, you know, not a lot of Mid-Atlantic kids who end up going to those northern schools. It's a lot of Mass, a lot of New York, right? Is that accurate?
No, that's fair.
So when you look at their roster right now, their leading scorer is from El Segundo, California. You mentioned Jake Haas from Wayland, Mass. Darien, Connecticut. I'm just going to list like 4 or 5 of these towns of their top scorers. Portland, Oregon. Allentown, Pennsylvania. Palo Alto, California. Potomac, Maryland. Hanover, Maryland. You know, Chicago, Illinois. So Los Angeles, California. I don't know if there's a team, you know, up north that has more geographic diversity, which is pretty cool, you know, for Coach McCormick, and to have, you know, the ability to, you know, use your academic arm a little bit to maybe go out and get some kids and lure them in that way. But really cool to see Williams playing at a high level. And I agree that sneakily, this could be the game we talk about on next week's podcast for the most time.
That's going to do it for our show. Thanks for listening. We really appreciate it. You can check us out on InsideTheCross.com. If you like the podcast, make sure to rate and leave a review. And next up is Matt Kinnear's interview with Tufts head coach Casey Knoppe.
We are here on the Inside the Cross Division 3 podcast with Tufts heads coach Casey D'Onofrio. Casey, you guys are off to a pretty good start, 9-0. Can't complain about that. You know, you guys have scored double digits in every game, so things are going pretty well for Tufts right now. How do you assess this first half of the season that you guys have played?
Well, first of all, Matt, thanks for having me. Like I said to you before, I think you guys are doing a fantastic job with this podcast. I think it's really good for the game, really good for Division III, and just really enjoy listening to it every week to hear your guys' thoughts on what's going on. We feel pretty good about where we are. I talked to you guys last year, and we are really just a process-driven team. So we're really not trying to focus on the wins and losses or the final score of everything, but, you know, are we playing as well as we possibly can, you know, every single day in practice and then ultimately every single game. And we feel like we're progressing in the right direction at this point and, you know, just getting a little bit better every time that we're on the field. So that's been really encouraging. And, you know, again, as far as the season's gone so far, you know, we've had the opportunity to, you know, play some really good teams and, you know, see the, you know, some teams that we've seen so far, whether it's Hamilton or Colby, you know, we feel like those guys are significantly improved from last year, and it's just making the NESCAC, you know, that much more challenging, you know, of a gauntlet to run throughout the year.
And Casey, I remember that conversation that we had, and you talked about your process. You know, where is that process when you get to this time of year? You know quite a bit about your team, but you have some really tough games ahead of you and all of your goals are still ahead of you. Where do you just kind of assess where the process lies here as we start April?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. You know, that's why we try and schedule as challenging of an out-of-conference schedule as we can. So, you know, if we go up and, you know, open the season and play at Hamilton and then play Cortland the next day on the road, you know, with no days off, you know, I think that's a good test for us in terms of, you know, really just taking care of the fundamentals and, you know, where's our mental toughness at, and then, you know, going and playing a, an absolute dogfight with Stevens Tech. And I feel like those guys are not getting the, you know, the love and the national polls that they deserve. I mean, I feel like they're without question the top 10 team. You know, just going on the road and playing those guys in a tough environment, you know, that sort of gives us a little bit of a litmus test in terms of where we're at. But really just trying to challenge the guys every single day in practice, you know, not so much, you know, at the end of the day, are we completing every single pass, or are we executing the offense or defense perfectly? But, you know, are we, you know, which team's picking up the tough guy GBs? Which team is, you know, finishing through the line on sprints? Which team is, you know, doing all the little things that are going to allow us to be successful? So then when we go back and we watch the film, you know, whether it's, you know, the Conn game on Saturday or, you know, the Stevenson game, even in those games where, you know, we sort of win those, you know, I would say maybe comfortably, which is more than five goals, is, you know, are we doing all of those little things correctly? And if the answer to that is yes, then okay, we're headed on the right track. And if the answer is no, then, you know, it really doesn't matter how much we win by, you know, that's unacceptable. So, you know, as we go into these games and, you know, we really do have a gauntlet ahead with Williams and Wesleyan and Amherst and Bates, you know, all being top 15 teams, you know, when we watch the film, you know, are we winning the tough guy GBs? Are we, you know, are we riding all the way to the midline? Are we showing the proper body language, you know, after goals that we score and goals that are scored against us? And so that's sort of where the process, you know, takes over. And, you know, that's where we have sort of the answers to, you know, are we headed in the right direction, or do we need to make some adjustments?
You know, each team, each season is different, but I feel like each program kind of has, you know, maybe some sort of consistent qualities to them. What is it about this year's Tufts team that might be unique or different or special from some of the others that you've been involved in the past?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think really the thing that's a little bit different about this team is just the depth that we have. You know, we're, you know, I think our, you know, our senior class is a really talented group, and, you know, they've got a couple All-Americans in there, and, you know, Danny Murphy, you know, before it's all said and done, will probably be one of our top two or three all-time leading scorers in program history. But then if you look down, I mean, we're running eight midfielders right now. And there's, you know, three or four other guys that aren't even getting on the field who we feel like are pretty special players. And they're doing a phenomenal job running our scout team right now and giving our defense a good look. You know, we feel like we have depth at the faceoff X for the first time, you know, maybe definitely as long as I've been here, you know, and then defensively, you know, we're playing some younger guys and that they're getting good experience as well. We've got great depth in the cage. You know, Mason Pollock's been our starter. But, you know, he was out with a sickness for a few games, and Joe Sawyer, who's a sophomore, stepped in and did a phenomenal job. And, you know, Ben Schmerler, who started some games for us in the past, has stepped in at times as well and done a great job. So I really think it's the depth, you know, that's separated us. And the other thing that allows us to do is just compete every day in practice. And guys really do feel like their job is on the line, because if they're not performing, there's guys underneath them, you know, that are gonna take their minutes from them. So that's been really, really fun every single day in practice, see those guys get after and compete.
And I think that's been one of the characteristics of some of the best teams, you know, that we've ever seen is obviously the depth, but just the competition level in practice, the willingness to compete, but also loving to compete, the mm-hmm. compete level. How do you teach that? You know, how do you kind of, is it just innate in the guys that you have? How do you kind of build that and kind of foster that as a program with all of your guys?
Yeah, I think the hardest part, you know, I've been on the other side where I've been, you know, coaching teams that don't have a ton of depth. I mean, we've had some really phenomenal players, but not a ton of depth. And, you know, teaching that competitive spirit in practice can be challenging if you don't have the depth, because you might tell a guy, hey, listen, if you're not getting the job done, you're not going to play. But if you don't have, you know, good enough players to play over that guy, then, you know, you're probably going to get your teeth kicked in. So once you have that depth, and I feel like, you know, we really do have it this year, you know, it's really just sort of the, hey, listen, it's a meritocracy. The best guys are going to play. And once you have that depth, you know, if guys aren't getting it done, whether they're seniors or juniors or freshmen, you know, somebody's going to play over them. So, you know, guys really do feel like their job's on the line. And, you know, if you go back and look at the box scores, there's some games when, you know, our first team All-American you know, midfielder has, you know, 6 or 7 points. And then there's other games where, you know, we're playing other guys more because we feel like those guys are, you know, more effective against a certain team or, you know, maybe had a better day in practice. And, you know, and I think that's where when the guys see it on the field and, you know, John Upton does a great job of running the offense and, you know, getting the right guys on the field, you know, it's sort of like, well, hey, why is that guy playing over me? Oh, well, you know, he had a better week of practice than I did. Or, you know, when he gets on the field, you know, he makes things happen. It's really just our guys understanding that the best guys are going to play and we don't care about accolades. We don't care about graduation year. We don't care about what guys did last year. It's just all about what are you doing now, you know, in this moment when your number's called. And, you know, the more that we can breed that and the more that we can play that up, you know, the more that it drives that competition and that competitiveness in practice.
Depth even more important for many teams in this shot clock era of men's lacrosse. I'm curious, how much has it changed things for you guys? Because the way you guys have played, I'm not sure if it's really made too much of an impact on the style of Tufts lacrosse.
Yeah, the shot clock hasn't really impacted us a whole lot. You know, the clear clock definitely has. It's definitely changed the way that we clear the ball. It's definitely changed the way that we've ridden the ball back a little bit. You know, what it really does is sort of change our mentality defensively. So, you know, whether we're playing a team that's trying to slow it down, you know, it adjusts the way that we play in the first 40 seconds of the shot clock if we know that a team's trying to run it down a little bit. And then also kind of, you know, when that shot clock hits, you know, 15 seconds, you know, we know that teams that we're playing are, you know, going to get outside of the box a little bit in terms of what they like to do. So whether that's, you know, kamikaze dodging towards the net or whether that's forcing the crease or whether that's, you know, pulling up from the outside. So it's really changed the way that we've sort of, you know, messaged what we're doing, you know, defensively at certain times in the shot clock. So really we get into that last, you know, 10 seconds, 12 seconds, 15 seconds. And it's really, that's the time where we have to lock in, be the most mentally tough and sort of expect the unexpected from the teams that we're playing.
Taking a little bit of a broader look to the overall landscape of Division III lacrosse before we get back to talk about your upcoming slate that you guys have, just what do you think of this year? You know, you mentioned that there's some teams that maybe historically have been easier wins on your schedule that were tough this year. And I think it's vice versa as well of, you know, maybe some programs that have historically been tough have been a little bit easier. How do you just overall see the talent shaping up in Division III and maybe, you know, how maybe a few things are different than maybe people are used to?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, again, I think one of the great things about what's going on in Division III lacrosse right now is if you look at sort of a bigger picture, is there's just more kids playing lacrosse, right? So there's more kids to recruit from. There's more programs to recruit from. So I think you're getting a lot of, you know, really, you know, talented coaches that are, you know, that are pounding the pavement and finding those guys and developing those guys. And so you definitely have your blue bloods, you know, the Salisburys and the RITs, you know, of the world that, you know, are going to get guys every single year. But now you just have more programs that are getting out there and finding guys, you know, that are really, you know, improving their programs. I mean, I think York is a great example. You know, I think Coach Child's doing a great job. But if you look up and down that roster, you know, you don't have guys from Nassau and Suffolk County, and you don't have guys from, you know, the MIAA. You've got guys from, you know, sort of around York and from, you know, Pennsylvania public schools, Maryland public schools. And I think that he's doing a great job pounding the pavement and finding those guys. You know, obviously, you know, I think Coach Thompson does a great job in his recruiting, and you look up and down his roster, I mean, he has a national roster. And I think that's an area where, you know, I think we've done a pretty good job the last few years of just, you know, expanding the locations where we're recruiting guys, because guys can play from everywhere now, you know, and it's not just the traditional powers. You know, I think some of our, you know, better guys are guys from sort of, you know, lesser known programs. And we just, you know, happen to find them, you know, because Tufts is near Boston and they want to be near a city. So I think that's where, you know, again, the coaches that are getting out there, you know, staying at a school for an extended period of time, pounding the pavement and finding these good guys are allowing, you know, more programs, you know, to flourish. And I think one of the things that's going to be really interesting this year is when you get to May and, you know, the NCAA selection committee has to figure out, you know, where are we going to seed everybody? Because in years past, you know, the South has been really strong, and, you know, they've definitely had more strong teams than the North, and then it's a little bit of a murderer's row getting through the South to make the national championship game. And this year, I think, you know, while the South may overall have more teams in the top 20, you know, I think if you look at the top 12 or top 15, you know, there's a really sort of a logjam of Northern teams. So where is it ultimately, you know, where are those teams going to shake out? Is it just going to be the North is going to be a murderer's row? And, you know, 8 of the top 10 teams in the country are going to be in the North, or is it, or are they going to choose to space it out a little bit and, you know, make it even and not make it so much North and South bracket, but really sort of make it a national bracket.
Speaking of a murderer's row, your guys start to April. You know, I know it's business as usual being in the NESCAC, but, you know, Williams on Wednesday night, then at Wesleyan, the defending national champions, at Amherst, it's the Saturday after that, the 13th, and that's a team that I think people, you know, have potential national championship aspirations for. This is quite a stretch here. How do you prepare for it?
Yeah, and don't forget Bates on the back end of that. You know, and then obviously then Middlebury and Bowdoin, which, you know, are two really, really good teams as well. Yeah, I mean, I think this is, you know, like you said, a little bit business as usual. I mean, we sort of expect some kind of, you know, stretch like this when we get into conference play. But I mean, just hats off to those coaching staffs for just reloading. You know, Williams, I thought, was really good last year, and they were sort of a year away. And now all those guys that were freshmen and sophomores last year, sophomores and juniors, and there, I mean, they are really good. We're watching them on film, and, you know, they look like a Division I team out there. But I think the most important thing, you know, for us is really just to take it one game at a time, you know, and talk about that process. And, you know, because if we start thinking about Wesleyan, Williams is going to beat us. Or if we're getting ready for Wes and, you know, we start thinking about Amherst, I mean, Wesleyan's going to, you know, knock us down pretty quickly. So it's really just sort of playing in the moment, worrying about the team that you're going to be playing, focusing on what they do. And then after that game, win or loss, you know, assess where you're at, and then, you know, move on to the next one. So I think that's, you know, that's where we really just, you know, that mental toughness kicks in, and we just have to focus on the team that we're going to play and not worry about anybody else who's coming up on the horizon. And, you know, just if you think about big picture, if we want to, you know, play as late into May as possible, you know, we're going to have to do this at some other point this year, you know, whether that's the NESCAC tournament, you know, and playing back-to-back teams that are in the top 10 and on championship weekend, or whether it's, you know, getting into the NCAA tournament where every team you're going to play is going to be a top 10 team. So, you know, this is great preparation for us. This is going to be a good test for where we're at in terms of our fundamentals, in terms of our mental toughness. And, you know, frankly, we're really looking forward to this stretch and these teams that we're going to play. And we just, you know, we love being challenged and, you know, love playing great teams. So this next 2 weeks is going to be, you know, it's going to be fun for us as a coaching staff. Challenging at times, but, you know, we love playing these talented teams.
You've been through the stretches like this as a player and, you know, also as a coach. How's it the same? How's it different? You know, what's your perspective like as a coach compared to a player?
Yeah, well, I think as a player, you're really focused on, you know, X's and O's and personnel and, you know, how am I going to perform physically? You know, and I think as a coach, you know, you're really thinking about, you know, how can we get our team, how can we get all of our guys, you know, in the right mental space first, but then in the right physical space. So, you know, what are we going to do at practice? What are we doing with the scout team? How much are we going to show them? Which games are we going to show them? You know, and where, you know, what's the messaging going to be? You know, because, you know, we were very fortunate to have, you know, Dom Starja come and talk to our team, you know, early in the year. And, you know, one of the things we talked about was, you know, no big games. And, you know, because he was basically like, you know, for them, when he was in Virginia, it was every game was a big game. You know, you're playing Carolina, then you're playing Syracuse, then you're playing Maryland. And, you know, and so after a while, you start talking about this is a big game, this is a big game. And, you know, the guys start to tune you out a little bit. So we've definitely had that sort of like no big games mentality. And it's all about us and how we're performing. So it's all about, okay, mentally, which buttons do we need to be pushing, you know, this week? Which buttons do we need to push going into the Williams game? And then depending on what happens there, you know, how much do we want to talk about 2018 when we talk about Wesleyan? Do we not want to talk about it? at all, you know, and I think that's where, you know, the preparation for us as a coaching staff is much more sort of what buttons are we going to push? Where do we need to be at mentally, and what's the messaging going to be?
Last question for you is just, if you had to pinpoint to one thing that's going to be, you know, determining of success or not success, whatever your definition of success is for the rest of this year, what is that going to be?
I honestly think, I know I've been saying it, I've been harping on it a little bit, but sort of, you know, mental toughness, and I would sort of, I would roll resilience, you know, into that as well. You know, win or loss, I don't really know what's going to happen over the course of the next four games, or the next six games of the regular season, but it's all about sort of how can we respond, you know, in those games. So, you know, let's say, you know, we go, you know, 4-0 in the next four games. You know, are we going to think that we're the greatest thing in sliced bread and not feel like we have to improve? You know, if we feel that way, then we're going to lose, and our season's going to end much earlier than we want it to. You know, if we go 0-4, you know, our guy's going to, you know, pick up this stick and ball and go home and just, you know, and just call it. Or if it's anywhere in between, you know, how are we going to respond, you know, in every game? You know, are we going to, you know, take a good, honest look at how we're doing, win or loss, and make the adjustments? Or are we going to listen to the guys inside the cross? Are we going to, you know, believe our press clippings? Are we going to listen to the parents and, you know, because they tell us we're the greatest thing ever, you know, every single game, win or loss? Or are we going to be honest with ourselves and say, hey, we need to get better. We need to get better. It doesn't matter, you know, that we won game X or game Y. You know, we need to get better going into the next one. So, you know, that mental toughness, that resilience, and, you know, just that reflection that we preach, you know, reflect, be honest with yourself. How can you improve? How can you improve mentally? How can you improve physically? How can you improve as a teammate? You know, is going to be huge over the course of the next 2 months.
Casey, good luck with this stretch here, and good luck for the rest of the season.
This is the Division 2, Division 3 podcast.